the Moan Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. After 5 days of impeachment hearings, House members head back to their districts ahead of next week's holiday. We'll hear if their constituents' appetite for an impeachment trial will be as big as their hunger for Thanksgiving dinner. Plus, how a Downey school's homework assignment has some parents claiming it struck an anti-immigrant racist tone. That and a lot more coming up when Take Two kicks off in just a few. Keep your ears here. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez, and a big old TGIF to you. And thanks for choosing us to close out your week. Coming up on the show, we'll explain why California's public universities are so darned expensive and why the humble tortilla demands a lot more of your respeto.
People tend to demonize tortillas and be like, oh, I want to lose weight. I'm going to cut out tortillas. No, what you should be doing is cut out like the 6 tacos that you eat and only eat like 2 of them.
Yeah, it's true. The tortilla is not the problem, as we will learn later in the show. And corn flour, it doesn't matter. It can make or break a dish. Stay tuned for that. First, though, it is time for State of Affairs. That's our weekly look at politics in the Golden State. And 5 days of impeachment hearings have wrapped up with 2 California congressmen taking center stage on opposite sides. Plus, when everyone was watching witness testimony, or maybe something else entirely, another debate among Democratic candidates for president took place. What happened and how did California's Kamala Harris do? Here to dissect it all is Zach Corser, co-director, Policy Lab, Claremont McKenna College. Welcome, Zach.
Happy Friday, eh?
Also, Marisa Lagos, political reporter for KQED and co-host of Political Breakdown Podcast. Marisa, welcome.
Glad to be here.
All right, so the 2 congressmen in question, Chair Adam Schiff and Ranking Member Devin Nunes, obviously trying to get 2 different things out there for these hearings. Marisa, how would you describe both of their approaches?
radically different.
Wow, that was a giggle right off the bat. All right.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. I mean, I think that Adam Schiff, who has really become the target of a lot of the right-wing ire, has really approached this as a prosecutor would, which is what he was, right? I mean, he's been very methodical, really, you know, deferring. I think the big difference in these hearings, quite frankly, to a lot of congressional hearings, is that a lot of the questioning happened by the lawyers, and that was by design. I think they wanted these to, you know, have some imprimatur of, like, gravitas, you know, that this didn't feel just like a political thing. And, you know, obviously there's still politics on both sides. But I think Adam Schiff has been very sort of professional and tried to keep it in what he and Democrats see as in that realm. Nunes has really come out as this attack dog for the president, often, you know, relaying conspiracy theories, accusing Democrats of conspiracy theories, even though I think it's fair to say that a lot of that has really been happening on the more conservative side and in conservative media. And a lot of times I think that he was not as effective with his line of questioning, but what he did do was make a lot of really clear statements about where he was coming from. I think if the president was watching, which we know he was on some days, he was probably happy with the way that Nunes defended him.
Now, Jim Jordan might disagree with you, Marisa, in terms of being the attack dog there for the hearings. But
yes.
Yeah. Now, when in terms of who they're talking to and if it worked, Zach, what do you think? Who were they talking to?
Well, that's what's really interesting about this is how much this whole impeachment proceeding so far, the inquiries, have been a reflection of our polarized politics, but in particular, our polarized media. You know, if you're tuning into Fox News and monitoring Hannity and shows like that or going into right-wing media, you're getting a very different version of events. And if you're watching mainstream media or, you know, the few people who are actually watching the hearings, I think they're getting a very different version of this. And it, what's striking to me is how little interaction there is, you know, whether it's between Nunes and Schiff, or I heard this great quote from David Axelrod. He described Jim Jordan as a human fog machine. The idea is just sort of flood the zone, put out as much disinformation as you can, have the right-wing media pick it up and run with it and present that version of events. Is this actually sort of, you know, moving the needle for people in the middle? I think I don't know. Looking at the polling that's been emerging recently, there was a poll that came out in Wisconsin this week that the president gave some attention to that sort of got some play in the media that was basically showing that the numbers are kind of freezing and maybe even slightly going down a bit on people's desires for impeachment and whether or not they actually think what actually happened in Ukraine was impeachable. But I think we also have to remember that this is still in the Intelligence Committee. It's the Judiciary Committee in the House that makes the decision about articles of impeachment. And so, you know, we've got a lot more to do, or the House does, and we as a public and the media have more to do to sort of watch these events unfold. And I think the goal of Republicans right now is to, you know, make this look to have as little credibility as possible.
Now, after 5 days of the hearings, that's what we have right now in our backpack. I'd like to hear from both of you about whether a case has been made for impeachment and why you think so or not. Marisa, let's start with you.
I mean, look, on the facts, nothing has changed since the White House released that memo of the transcript, right? I mean, essentially what most of these witnesses did, many of them, I want to say, very earnest civil servants, you know, career diplomats who really, I think, strived to put forward a nonpartisan accounting of events. They really all backed up what was the accusation of the whistleblower and really what we saw in that call transcript. So if you think that the president leaning on Ukraine for a political investigation and using the leverage of a White House meeting and, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in foreign aid is in fact impeachable, then absolutely they prove this point. I mean, what we've seen repeatedly, though, is critics of impeachment say, we don't think that this rises to the level. They're not really quibbling with the facts of what we've seen laid out. So I think on that, you know, idea, Democrats really did what they set out to do. But I, again, like back to what Zach is saying, I don't know that it's changing the public's mind. People are so in their corners that it just almost seems like nothing you could do would really change that fact.
Zach, what about you?
Well, I think I agree with Marisa about this idea of the threshold of what counts as impeachable. If you think back to 1998, one of the first things that Republicans did during the Judiciary Committee's impeachment hearings about Clinton was they actually held a hearing about the definition of what is an impeachable offense, you know, the idea of high crimes and misdemeanors. And, you know, Adam Schiff, he is a former prosecutor. He's been taking a move towards a more legalistic approach, you know, using the language of, you know, what is the federal definition of bribery statutes, for example, and breaking the law. But ultimately, the American people have to be, you know, we have to capture the constitutional sense of the people and define, and it's kind of a moving target, you know, what are people going to actually think is impeachable? Because we don't have a recourse to the law books to tell us, or the Constitution even, what is impeachable. You've got to convince the people of whatever that is and convince them that this meets that threshold. And it's a very difficult political kind of argument that I think is going to be continue to emerge throughout this whole process. But at this point, I think, you know, everyone's in their corners. I don't see a lot of movement at this moment.
Well, let's dive in a little bit deeper into what the people may think, because Marisa, members of the House are now heading back to their districts. They're going to be back in session December 3rd. So I'm wondering how much of an opportunity will this be to maybe take their constituents' temperature on what we've seen and heard and what actually might be to come?
I mean, I think absolutely that is what's going to be happening. You know, congressmen and women from all over the nation will be listening and hopefully holding some town halls and doing that work. And I do think that that is really where the rubber meets the road on this. You know, I think that we have seen a pretty unbreakable sort of unshakable defense of the president by Republicans. If they felt like there was a change among their constituents, that there was a real sea change of opinion, especially in really deep red places, I think you might see a shift, but I don't think we've seen that. I think Zach brought up, you know, the idea that most people don't have the time to be watching 11 hours of impeachment hearings a day and then the Democratic debates we're going to get to. So, I really do feel like a lot of this is that sort of elusive swing voter, the centrist of the nation. And I just question whether a lot of those people are super involved in communicating with their congressmen and women when they come home on these breaks, or if they're even paying attention to these hearings, quite frankly.
Zach, what about a purple district, like say District 25, the one Katie Hill just resigned from? It's vacant right now, but it was purple when she won it. What about a district like that?
To be honest with you, I mean, thinking about this from a congressional angle, thinking about this in terms of 2020 election, you know, I think congresspeople are best to try to shift the conversation towards policy as much as they can. I mean, I don't know that's actually really possible. I mean, in terms of what Washington's talking about right now, what the media is talking about, impeachment is crowding almost everything else out. But I don't think it makes a lot of sense, particularly in a purple district like the 25th, to start going in hot and heavy talking about, you know, what do you think about impeachment? I think it's more like, what are you going to do in terms of policy. And that actually might be a better argument for Republicans to make if they don't want to engage in impeachable offense, to say that this is a huge distraction. We need to get back to the business of America. And I think the more that the impeachment inquiry and the impeachment articles start to abut against the Democratic primaries in New Hampshire and Iowa, the better that message may resonate. So I think there's a real urgent timeline here, and I don't think congresspeople or the presidential candidates want to sort of get their messages mixed in all of this impeachment.
We're talking State of Affairs with Zach Corser, co-director, Policy Lab, Claremont McKenna College. Also, Marisa Lagos, political reporter for KQED and co-host of the Political Breakdown podcast. Now, about the debate, there was one on Wednesday night. It wasn't daytime TV, daytime drama TV, like we saw for about a week and a half. But it was largely overshadowed in a lot of ways by the proceedings. If these hearings go nowhere else but the Senate, Zach, could the things we've heard motivate voters on both sides to come to the polls next year?
Well, I don't know. It's kind of unprecedented to think about the potential removal of a president, because that's ultimately what the Senate will be making a decision of, assuming the House does send its articles of impeachment, and then turning the page almost immediately to deciding who's going to replace this president at the polls in 2020. And I think we're sort of in uncharted territory. I don't know how these two things can fit together or will fit together. The Republicans have been trying to talk about the idea that impeachment is essentially trying to cancel the 2016 election, that somehow this is overwriting history, not that this is about the conduct of a president and whether or not his actions deem removal. But they may get more and more traction the more this goes on. I honestly don't know how this is going to work out. I think it'll be a very weird mix to see, a drawn-out impeachment process going into next year in the Senate, sort of side-by-side by talking about Democratic candidates, and then Donald Trump himself being on the campaign trail, which he will be, absolutely, as this goes forward.
Marisa, how much does talking about impeachment before, during, and after a debate help or hurt the candidates, and then by extension, the Democratic Party?
Well, I mean, we're talking about two things here, right? We're talking about a Democratic primary in which the party faithful are weighing in, and then we have to pivot to a general election as we do every 4 years. So I think there's absolutely an argument that Democrats may be making to their party faithful about this impeachment hearing. I mean, Republicans are right about one thing. Many Democrats feel that Trump never should have been president. And so if candidates can harness that while still talking about their policies and what makes them different from the other candidates, sure, it might play in. But I do think that there is this danger, which is, again, that center, the swing voters, the people maybe in places who don't like the idea that this is, if they're buying, the conservative argument that this is a political move really aimed at stripping a duly elected president of his office. And so I think it gets a little sticky. And then that's not even to speak of like the timeline here. I mean, Senate is in, its proceedings while we're going to the Iowa caucuses, what does that do to the senators, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris, who need to be doing both?
Well, let's hear from Kamala Harris. She was on MSNBC the morning after the debate and was asked how she thought it all went.
I thought it was a good night. A lot of important issues were covered, there's so much at stake, and as I say often, if not all the time, justice is on the ballot, and so talking about the various injustices, including the subject matter of the impeachment process, it's an important discussion.
So, Zach, it sounds there that she's okay with making impeachment a debate topic. But as Marisa just said, if it winds up going to the trial right up against the Iowa caucus, it could tie up some of the candidates in a trial. I mean, you've got a lot of senators that are running for the Democratic nomination. I mean, how could this play out, and how might the Democratic Party maybe be scrutinized for politically walking and chewing gum at the same time?
Well, Trump will run a mile with this, basically saying that how can we, he's very big on trying to, essentially impeach the judgment of his critics. And he'll basically say, Kamala Harris should recuse herself, and Cory Booker, he should recuse himself. They shouldn't have a role in this. They're clearly enemies. They couldn't be unbiased. He'll treat this like it's a courtroom drama.
Cory Booker
than a constitutional,
and Bernie Sanders. I mean, there's a lot
Bernie
of
Sanders.
Yeah.
Yeah, and basically say
they
should all leave the chamber. They shouldn't be a part of this. I'm sure that's going to be a talking point. So it's going to be really troubling in terms of, I think, mixed messages going into this. And I think all those senators have to have a pretty good response to why they should be in that room and why they should be vocalizing a decision about removing the president when they're actually, you know, declared against him for 2020.
Although I will say, just to jump in, you know, we saw today the Washington Post report that the Senate, you know, Senate leadership has essentially told Trump he gets to pick how long of a trial this gets to be.
Oh, wow.
So I think that it's a little, it would be a little bit disingenuous, and I'm not saying he won't still use the argument, but to argue that, you know, the senators have prejudged things when the Senate leadership seems to be deferring to him on his own trial.
It's Marisa Lagos, political reporter for KQED, co-host of the Political Breakdown podcast, and also Zach Corser, co-director, Policy Lab, Claremont McKenna College. Marisa, Zach, thanks a lot.
Had a great weekend.
Imagine for a second that you're an immigrant parent of a kid in an LA area school. Now, your kid shows you a study guide to help memorize the names of states using a mnemonic device. Now, to help remember California, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas, those states are spelled out in a word, can't, in a sentence. Innocent, right? Here's a sentence. You can't just cross the border. That happened in Downey. Find out how when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. A study guide for school kids caused an uproar among some parents in Southeast LA County recently when fifth graders at an elementary school in Downey brought home a handout that many parents complained came off as anti-immigrant. KPCC's Eric Galindo is here to explain what happened. Hi.
Hey.
All right. So tell us about this study guide. What was in it that caused this controversy?
Yeah, it's a handout with several pages of mnemonic devices meant to help students memorize the names of states and their capitals. It was handed out earlier this month to some fifth graders at Gallatin Elementary, a school in the Downey Unified School District. One of the mnemonic tricks in the handout is this phrase, "You can't just cross the border," with C-A-N-T written over California, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas.
So the word can't, California, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas.
Exactly. Okay. And parents in Downey, which is this affluent, overwhelmingly Latino city in Southeast Los Angeles County, saw this messaging as anti-immigrant, possibly racist, at the very least inappropriate for 9 and 10-year-olds.
How did you find out about this?
Actually, I had a few parents send me photos of the assignment, and they were really upset. Like, many of them brought up the fact that this was happening at a time when children that look like their children are being held in cages at the border, and Latinos are being targeted in mass shootings, like the shooting in El Paso, Texas this past summer. In fact, as upset as they were, parents I talked to didn't want to use their last names. They said they didn't want their kids to be targets.
Wow.
Yeah, one parent named Jose told me it was especially concerning that a study guide with that kind of message was reaching them in this town that's about 70% or more Latino.
We have to, like, talk about this kind of stuff because there's still that old school racism in there. Like, and it's the perfect example of how this is just, like, a normal thing or this wouldn't be something in Downey.
So where did this study guide come from?
It appears to be inspired by a 5-year-old YouTube video by someone calling herself Miss Alexander. And it's popular, too, with about 750,000 views and several other popular videos that copycat her and try her technique out. Let's listen to a little bit right now.
The very first thing we're going to start with is can't. California, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas. This is the Mexican border. You can't cross the border without the right paperwork.
The study guide itself came from a website called Teachers Pay Teachers, which is a resource for educators.
What did the Downey Unified School District tell you that happened here? I mean, and did you track down the people who made the study guide in the first place?
The district says it was an honest mistake. They said the teacher at Gallatin Elementary printed out the handout from teacherspayteachers.com, and the teacher just didn't review it. They say it was a voluntary handout. About a dozen kids took it home. Once they were made aware of the questionable page by some upset parents, they took it back, the guides, and then they shredded them, and they filed a report to Teachers Pay Teachers.
How has this all ended up? And maybe we'll be seeing more of can't in kids' U.S. geography study guides.
Well, that's hard to say. The YouTube video is still up there, but at least you won't find it on Teachers Pay Teachers anymore. The website, which is just like an online marketplace, sort of like Amazon, where sellers can create educational materials and sell them. They say they have millions of sellers, and they rely on the community to report materials that violate their guidelines. After I showed them this handout, they said it was in violation of their terms and they removed it from Teachers Pay Teachers. And I checked and I can't find it there anymore.
All right, that's KPCC's reporter on emerging and immigrant communities, Eric Galindo. And you can read Eric's reporting this afternoon on LAIST, that's LAIST.com. Eric, thanks a lot.
No problem. Thank you.
All right, now to high ed. A Southern California college created for Native Americans 2 years ago doubled its enrollment this year. Administrators say its appeal is due in part to its mission to provide educational opportunities that aren't usually available to Native Americans. KPCC's Adolfo Guzman Lopez reports.
Many of the new students at California Indian Nations College grew up in the Coachella Valley.
My name is Savannah Sobel, and I grew up in Palm Springs, and I'm an Agua Caliente tribal member.
Sabo heard about the school this year and was curious. A college with Native American faculty, Native subject matter, and Native student body? With a few exceptions, she felt invisible as a Native American during her public schooling and 2 years of community college.
What was missing was just that camaraderie, having someone, you know, to speak to about whatever was going on, you know, in your tribe or, you know, a gathering.
Do you think not having Native instructors kind of contributed to you losing interest in college?
I could say it played a role.
Sobel is part of a troubling statistic. Compared to other races and ethnic groups, Native Americans are among the least likely to earn a degree from a California public university or community college. Sobel stopped going to community college 10 years ago, but this summer she decided to try again after she heard about California Indian Nations College. She signed up for the business class.
Having Professor Thomas, he's a, you know, former marketing guy from casino background, and he's also a member of a tribe.
On a recent Tuesday night, Professor Aaron Thomas welcomes students as they're walking into the classroom.
Cabazon's in the house. All right. Torres Martinez.
Those are two of the Indian nations in the Coachella Valley. That simple act of acknowledging, he says, is part of the support that makes this class different. Once class starts, something else becomes obvious. Thomas's tribal background shows a very different side to business lessons.
If your tribe is very heavily into hospitality and they've been a great host for thousands of years, whoever came through your territory, wouldn't you use that in your business? Heck yeah, man.
He says it's important for Native students to see the overlap between Native and non-Native culture.
We live in two different worlds, and to be able to have the knowledge on the traditional side of who they are and also the non-traditional side can only make them a stronger leader.
It's never been more urgent to have more Native Americans with college degrees, says California Indian Nations College Vice President Robert Prozaclasa.
They have tribal governments that hold equal position to that of states, and a number of them operate multi-million and even multi-billion dollar business enterprises, mostly centered on gaming, but with increasing diversification.
The college has been open for less than 2 years, the second such institution in the state. 82 students enrolled this year, and the college hopes to enroll 200 in 5 years. It's using startup funds donated by the 29 Palms Band of Mission Indians to pay for salaries for its 16 faculty and staff and for office and classroom rental at a UC Riverside facility. After less than 2 years, it's too soon to compare academic performance at California Indian Nations College to mainstream schools, but the tribal focus is making a difference for Savannah Sobel. After finishing the business class, she wants to earn her associate's degree, which she hopes will open doors at her tribe.
Once you have your AA, you can sign up and you get do a rotation in different departments, and then, you know, hopefully you can land a job or go on to something else.
That something else is a dream, she says. After earning a 4-year degree, she wants to run for the Agua Caliente Tribal Council. There are no women serving on it now. Covering higher education, I'm Adolfo Guzman Lopez.
All right, moving on. This month on KPCC, familiar voices are reading amendments to the Constitution. You may have already heard artist Shepard Fairey on the right to a jury trial, or maybe Fresh Air's Terry Gross read the First Amendment. It's all part of the nationwide Purple Project for Democracy, a nonpartisan campaign to recommit to democratic values and institutions. Here is today's installment.
Hi, I'm B.D. Wong. Your public radio station is celebrating American democracy by presenting the amendments to the U.S. Constitution that lay out our freedoms and how democracy works. The Fourth Amendment was ratified in 1791 as part of the Bill of Rights, and it says the government needs to show probable cause of a crime for an arrest or search. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized.
That was actor B.D. Wong reading the Fourth Amendment on probable cause. Okay, so Thanksgiving, less than a week away. Are you ready? Or at least, are you getting ready to get ready? Now, whether you've done all of your shopping or not, we want to hear about how you are preparing and maybe what you plan to serve, too. After all, I mean, Southern California is home to a thriving multicultural community, each with its own customs and its own traditions that produce a unique take on holiday festivities. We'd love for you to share with us how you celebrate. From the food to the table to how you spend your day. I'm going to be watching football. Yeah, big surprise on me, right? Now, so far, we've gotten some pretty heartwarming responses, including from Jeanette Reese, who hosts a potluck Thanksgiving for seniors who otherwise would spend the holidays alone. Or maybe even Chelsea Bagnard, who told us how red cabbage makes her meal special. It's a Danish dish her mother was sure to incorporate for the occasion. So what tradition or dish makes your Thanksgiving Day unique? Tell us. Head on over to take2.org, click on today's show, and find the form at the bottom of the page to tell us all about it. I remember this phrase from a decade ago that became a New York political party: the rent is too damn high. Well, here in California, the same could be said about college tuition. So how in the last 150 years did we go from UC's original charter to make school free to where it is now, unaffordable for lots of people? Find out when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. Now, this is not news to anyone, but nowadays it is a rare thing to leave college without debt. On average, California grads leave their institutions owing more than $20,000, and many owe a lot more than that. Now, it used to not be like this. A few decades ago, you could actually graduate from college debt-free with a job and then be on a path toward buying a house. That's real. That's not a fantasy. That's the way it used to be. So what happened? Felicia Mello, higher education reporter for the news site Cal Matters, is here with some answers. Felicia, welcome back to Take Two.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so let's focus on the price tag first. How much more are students paying than their parents and grandparents for college?
Well, they're paying quite a bit more. You know, we think of free college as this relatively new idea, but in fact, that was the original idea at the founding of the University of California, that college would be free for residents of the state. But since then, we've seen fees actually increase over the years and turn into tuition, and undergraduate fees at UC grew at nearly five times the rate of inflation between 1977 and 2018. So just to give you a little perspective, even going back a bit bit further. Let's say you're an undergrad at UC in 1960, you're going to be paying about $120 a year in fees. Adjusted for inflation, that only works out to about $1,000 in today's dollars. But we actually know that folks are paying more than $12,000 in tuition to attend UC today.
Wow, that's nothing. I mean, that's can you imagine if that were anywhere near the reality today? I mean, everyone would go to college. What was the first thing that happened to trigger a spike in that tuition from the 60s to now?
Well, I think there have been a couple reasons. One thing is when the state has been in periods of budget crisis, that's when it's tend to pull back its subsidies of public education. So you see this fluctuation based on how the state economy is doing. And then sometimes it was for ideological reasons, too. Governor Ronald Reagan at one point said that the state should not subsidize intellectual curiosity. And I think that kind of exemplifies this mentality of both small government, but also, you know, it was a time of a lot of social upheaval. You had massive protests on campuses, and the idea was maybe these students are out there doing all these extracurricular activities, and, you know, why are we paying their bills?
That's a rough thing to hear.
Yeah, it's pretty wild.
Now, fast forward to the recession in 2008. What happened to the high ed spending then?
Well, it tanked as a result of our lawmakers looking for cuts in the state budget. It has begun to rebound since then. So California's economy has since improved. And so state spending and higher ed has increased again. However, has not climbed back up to the levels it was at per student, say, in the year 2000. And the other thing to note is just that, again, tuition tends to rise during a period of recession, but we don't necessarily see those tuition increases then walked back when the state economy is doing better.
What about private colleges, private universities? It just feels like that's always been more expensive anyway.
So with private colleges, it's a little bit more complex what's driving the increase in cost. Researchers point to a few things. One thing they say is that it's become more of a requirement these days to have a college degree, to get a decent job. So over the years, as that happened, demand for higher education in general grew. You know, in some cases, private colleges trying to compete for students and having these fancy amenities like fancy dorms and recreation centers. And then finally, this idea that price is actually a signaler. Students and families might actually think that because a private college is more expensive, that means it's more elite and they're going to get a better education. But in many cases, private colleges do have quite a bit of financial aid so that students aren't necessarily paying the sticker price. And often low-income students are not actually aware that that can be the case for them, that they can actually get financial aid at private colleges that might in some ways be more than what they're able to access at public schools.
Talking to Felicia Mello, higher education reporter with Cal Matters. How much do high housing costs and other living expenses factor into a student's ability to afford college? I mean, it's high in California, so that has to add to the ticket.
That's a huge part of the cost. And in fact, it's a more significant piece of the cost these days than tuition and fees, in part for exactly what you were talking about, that we're in the midst of a massive housing crisis in California. And this is particularly an issue for community college students because we have a state financial aid system that emphasizes tuition. California is actually relatively generous with its financial aid compared to other states. We say if you are a high school student, you're about to graduate, or you've been out of high school less than a year, and you are low income, you are entitled to a Cal grant that will help you pay for tuition. But there's not as much aid available to cover living expenses, and so community college students who don't pay as much in tuition but do have all those same living expenses can often really struggle to pay these costs.
Now, taking all of that into account, into one big giant pot, how is all this affecting the quality of a student's education?
Well, we see a lot of students that are struggling with homelessness, food insecurity. Obviously, that can have an impact on how well they're able to focus on their studies. And we also see students that are working really long hours in order to close that gap between their financial aid and the full cost of attendance. So studies show that if you work up to 15 hours a week, that it doesn't necessarily compromise your education and can, in fact, contribute to your education. But there is some research showing that if you're working more than that, say you're working 30 hours a week, 40 hours a week while trying to study full time, that's going to impact your grades, and it's also going to slow down your progress toward graduation.
This average student that we're talking about here, tell us about this person. Who is collecting this debt?
Students in California are much more ethnically diverse They're more likely to come from low-income households, and they're more likely to be the first in their families to attend college than they were a couple of decades ago. So University of California undergraduates, 41% of them now are the first generation in their family to attend college. That's compared with only 10% just 20 years ago. And so sometimes these students struggle even more to kind of cope with the cost of college. And some of the assumptions that lawmakers might have made in the past when they were setting higher education policy don't necessarily hold up. So in some cases, you might assume that, you know, an 18-year-old college student is relying on their parents for money to buy textbooks or to pay rent, when in fact a lot of these students may be in the opposite situation. They may actually be trying to contribute money to help support their families.
Wow. All this sounds like such a steep hill to climb for that average student. What can be done about this?
Well, so there are a couple bright spots. One is, as I mentioned, California does provide significant aid for tuition, more so than a lot of other states. And I think that has created the room to kind of start having this other conversation about how do we as a state cope with all of these other non-tuition costs like food and housing. In the past couple of years, we've seen students turn up en masse to hearings in the state legislature to talk about being homeless and food insecure. And I think that's created an continuing momentum for policy to start to address some of these challenges. So there's a task force right now that's being convened by the Student Aid Commission to look at solutions to cover some of the non-tuition costs of college. The state is now, you know, projected to have up to a $26 billion surplus in the next couple of years. So there's certainly discussions happening at the state level about whether to allocate some of that to expand our financial aid programs. And that task force is due to issue a report to the legislature by March of next year.
All right, that's Felicia Mello, higher ed reporter with Cal Matters, talking to us about the crushing cost of college. Felicia, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
It can't feel too good to be an afterthought. I mean, put yourself in the shoes of the humble tortilla. Can't make a taco without one, but it is always seen in a supporting role, literally supporting the star of the taco, the meat. No, that ends today. That ends now. Coming up next, the tortilla gets some LA love. That's next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. All right, we've come to the end of our week, a time where we can all hopefully get a little respite, enjoying some of the good things in life, like eating. So for today's installment of Food Friday, we bring you the best tortilla-based dishes in Los Angeles and where to find them. And our guide is, who else? LA Taco editor Javier Cabral. One of his recent articles on the site highlights the 12 ways to eat a tortilla, but I'll let him tell you all about it.
So this is a tortilla map, and I'm sure that whoever's out there listening is, what is a tortilla map? LA, tortillas is the staple food of the city. You know, you find it in tacos, tostadas, enchiladas, chilaquiles. So this map is meant to define and help people navigate through LA's tortilla landscape, as I call it.
Because there's a lot of places where you could get that, right? So you want to find the best spots, and what better way to do it than with a map?
And a typical question is like, you know, what is the difference between a taco dorado and a flauta? Do you know what that is?
I can't tell you. I would know right off the top of my head. No.
So they're both fried. A taco dorado is folded over once, whereas a flauta is rolled up into a little tube. So it's little differences like that that end up making a big difference in texture and flavor. One day, if you're craving the best enchiladas, and when I say enchiladas, I mean like, you know, like the Mexican way of eating it, where they're griddled, they're a little crispy. They're not like the saucy casserole type American made enchiladas. These are like real kind of enchiladas. And for that place, I recommended La Casita Mexicana. It's a foundational restaurant in Bell, California, in Southeast LA. Yeah. And that place makes the best enchiladas in LA.
They used to be near where my wife worked, and she used to go there all the time with all the people at work. Yeah.
It's kind of like a good spot. It's the place. You know, for same thing for chilaquiles and moladas, which is like an enchilada, but instead of a chile sauce, you use mole. It is as delicious as it sounds like. For that place, you go to Gelaguetza, you know, in Koreatown, another Oaxacan restaurant that has that. And that's the thing about this guide, wasn't really meant to be a definitive guide of where to find it in LA. It was more to navigate. If you love Mexican food in LA, which you probably do if you live here, now you have this map to be able to guide you from what is the difference between an enmolada and a enchilada and a tostada and a mulita. Mulita, you know, which being like the variation of a taco with cheese in it and two handmade tortillas. You know, because it gets confusing out there.
Oh, yeah. There's a million different spots. Give us one more place. You mentioned two already. Give us one more spot.
So let's say for mulitas. Mulitas, it's a taco sandwich that is filled with cheese and whatever meat. And the place that we all agreed was the best place for that was Teddy's Red Tacos. Teddy's Red Tacos being one of the first guys in LA to bring birria, because before that it was more like the Jalisco style made out of goat. And Teddy's Red Tacos, because of all the aggressive spicing in the birria with the cheese, really helps it to come together and taste good.
Where's Teddy's?
Teddy's is in South LA.
This must have been very tough for you, Javier, because I mean, think of all the different places that you had to consider and then cut. I mean, how did you narrow it down? What criteria did you use to narrow it down to the ones that you mentioned?
Yeah, you're right. It is hard because in LA, there's so many good tacos and so many competitors. But my criteria was like places that were semi-easy to get to, places that were very user-friendly so it wouldn't intimidate people, and places that that were the most consistent and tasty. You know, for example, for quesadillas, I recommended a quesadilla lady in Echo Park. She's a street vendor, and her cart is called Alejandra's Quesadilla Cart. When I say quesadilla, I'm not talking about like, you know, the quesadillas that you and I probably grew up with and, you know, just put some tortilla and a cheese on the house and call it a day. These quesadillas are more Mexico City or Southern style, where they're filled with squash blossoms, tlacoche, which is like the corn fungus, with chicken tinga on a handmade tortilla with cheese, and then it's like a combination of a taco and a quesadilla, and one is so delicious, and that place is also on the list.
Talking to LA Taco editor Javier Cabral about his article, 12 Ways to Eat a Tortilla in LA and Where to Find It. Now, reading through the article, you kind of get a sense and realize how many ways a tortilla can be used, and the utility is kind of amazing. So, I mean, is that lost, do you think, Javier, sometimes when people think of the humble tortilla?
Yeah, you know what? Right now, we're seeing the tortilla finally get the respect that it deserves. You know, people are taking it less for granted. Remember, when you eat a taco, it's not all about the meat on top, although it's easy to just focus on that because, you know, meat is good, it's juicy, it's like savory.
Yeah.
But, you know, a taco is 50% tortilla and 50% meat. So the tortillas right now, we're seeing like organic tortillas coming out of LA finally from these guys in Boyle Heights called Kernel of Truth Organics. So corn tortilla, always look at the label, it should only have three ingredients, corn, water, and lime.
That's it. Okay.
Anything else is you will taste it because it's such a pure, simple product.
But let me ask you this. There's yellow corn, there's white corn, then there's flour. I mean, is there a right and a wrong tortilla?
No, there's a tortilla for every mood of the day.
You would say something like that too.
You know, it's like sometimes, you know, for breakfast I'll have flour tortillas, but then for dinner I'll have some kind of masa like manipulation. The good thing is that for corn tortillas, don't forget that they are a whole grain product.
Yeah.
And people tend to demonize tortillas and be like, oh, I want to lose weight, I'm going to cut out tortillas. No, what you should be doing is cut out like the six tacos that you eat and only eat like two of them. You know, so don't forget corn tortillas have kept an entire country and civilization afloat since like the 1500s.
Does it matter how the corn is processed though?
Yeah, it does matter, yes. Again, because we have gone so far from the origins of a tortilla. Mm. So again, tortillas come from field corn, which is a starchier corn. It's not like the sweet corn that we like chew into, you know, and like for Thanksgiving or whatever. You shuck that and you separate them and you put them in a solution of lime. Calcium propionate, which is a pickling lime or slaking lime, is a common name. You let that sit, boil, and then you grind it, and then you make it like a masa. That is what you squash and toast into a tortilla.
Now, Javier, I can already hear some people say, well, we can't all be Javier Cabral, editor of LA Taco, and just drive around and make it our job to taste all these places. I just got to go to the supermarket, to the store, buy myself some tortillas, and make something at home. So what about that part? Did you include some of that in your article?
Yeah.
The best places to buy them?
Yeah. I mean, another big brand in LA that has been doing it the right way for a couple of decades now is Diana's Tortillas. And aside from that, you know, I would just recommend just Googling a tortilleria. Luckily, in LA, we have so many tortillerias that make their tortillas from scratch. And, you know, and make a thing out of it and go pick up some tortillas and masa from there. And if you are serious about what you put in your body, you should also be serious about the tortillas that you eat.
You mentioned earlier how there's a tortilla for every occasion, right? So I was going to put you on the spot. At least I thought I was when I was going to ask you corn or flour, but I guess it doesn't matter, right?
Come on, like there's wonderful restaurants that in LA that are now redefining what flour tortillas are. And they're changing perspectives like through every bite. You know, like first restaurant that comes up is Sonora Town in downtown LA. You know, they make their own flour tortillas. And I guarantee you, anyone that still think flour tortillas are less authentic than corn tortillas, take them there and give them a taco like carne asada. And like, ask them, do you still think that flour tortillas are not as authentic as corn? And let me know what they say.
That's editor of LA Taco, Javier Cabral, joining us as our official guide on tortillas in Los Angeles. Javier, thanks a lot.
Thank you, eh? See you guys.
All right, finally, if you're looking to get out there and do stuff before Thanksgiving next weekend, we got advice for you.
I'm KPCC's Leo Duran. A. Martinez, I am in the holiday spirit.
Oh, good, good.
Yeah, so I've got a selection of events all happening this weekend that'll take their ho-ho-holes on you.
Okay, what's the first one?
Okay, so as a hint, Santa... Wow, okay, really threw you. Santa, of course. While that rain we got earlier this week was refreshing, head up up in the mountains, that meant snow. So that means right now, it's actually the perfect wonderland to visit Sky Park at Santa's Village. This is in the town of Sky Forest, right by Lake Arrowhead in the San Bernardino Mountain Range. It's open starting today, and it's an outdoor adventure park with ice skating, puppet shows, craft workshops, and a meet and greet with Santa himself, plus those old holiday traditions like axe throwing and zip lining. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm serious. That's actually a thing up there too. So obviously, this place is for kids and adults. It's open now until early January, and tickets start at $49.
All right, what if I want to celebrate the holidays without a winter coat?
Well, then head to Laguna Beach tomorrow and Sunday. There you can enjoy a winter fantasy at their Sawdust Art Festival. It's where the art village becomes this snowy wonderland, but you know, it'll actually just float down there, float down on you, but it won't be cold enough for it to stick around. Plus, there's going to be almost 200 artists there to shop holiday gifts from, art demonstrations, a petting zoo, and a Santa, too, so Santa gets around. And this sticks around until a few days before Christmas, so you'll have plenty of time to go. But head over there tomorrow afternoon, and you'll be able to catch the tree lighting ceremony. When you go to this one, admission starts at $4.
All right, now, speaking of gifts, I've got some geeks in my family I need to buy gifts for.
You are just talking about yourself, aren't you?
Maybe. Yeah, maybe.
I know maybe. You do love comic book superheroes. You're a big fan of The Flash. I love geeky things too, and also cool art. So there's actually something for all of us at DesignerCon.
Oh,
this happens in Anaheim today through Sunday. It's a convention where you can shop from designer toy makers, pop artists, illustrators, and more. There'll also be special events like a live painting competition and a Spider-Verse, like Into the Spider-Verse, VR experience with stuff from the film. And when you go to this one, passes start at $30.
All right, sweet. Now, what if I want to do something that'll help me wind down after a rough week?
Well, then take in the quiet beauty of the Magical Chinese Lantern Festival in Pomona. It starts tomorrow through early January. And this show features amazing displays of light sculptures that you can actually walk around and take pictures with, like a ceramic dragon that is basically the length of a football field. Mm. The theme this year is called Blooming Seasons, and this means that there'll be plant-themed displays, like a walkway lined with lanterns shaped like cacti and stuff like that. So this is a great way to see modern takes on this ancient art forms and just, you know, really breathe and take it in.
Damn.
When you go to this one, tickets start at just over $15. Now, that's actually not all. The KPCC LAS gang have a lot more to share of what to do this weekend. You can check it out on LAIST.com. That is LAIST.com. Plus, you can also find me on Twitter if you want to. It's at Leo Has a Cat.
That's our own Leo Duran. Leo, thanks a lot.
See you later.
All right, that's it for Take Two this week. Our producers are Lori Skywalker Galaretta, Austin Cross, and Leo Duran. Austin Leo also directed the show this week. Emily Henderson helped us out with some production, as did Ari Saperstein. Tamika Adams is our news apprentice. The show is engineered by Hazmeet Pogosian, and our senior producer and editor is Megan Larson. And if you missed any part of Take Two today, you missed out on a good one. Just go wherever you get your podcast. There we will be waiting to be heard by you. You can also find us all over social media. We're at Twitter at Take Two. That's at Take Two. And I'm there as well at A Martinez LA. That's at A Martinez LA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back Monday at 2. Talk to you then.